So tonight, lights, these two lights. I'm going to present an old friend, the frog in the well. Now, how many people are here for the first time? Anybody? Few. Very good. Thank you. So most of you here are probably familiar with this parable for our time. But I was thinking that it would be a good review of this basic principle of Krishna consciousness, which deals with epistemology, how we know what we know, because we can also use it for convincing others. I mean, it's good to review these basic principles and to so that we can therefore establish the real basis of transcendental knowledge. So the frog of the well is a parable for our time. Now this frog, this is Dr. Frog. He's in the well. And I will give you... Okay, let me see. I have to... So what happened was there was a well right near the ocean, near the Pacific Ocean. And in that well, there was a community of frogs. And they lived there for generations, actually, and developed a whole frog culture. And there was a university. And in that university, there was a chief professor. And that professor was knowledgeable of all the ins and outs, the history, the culture of that well. So he was known as Professor Frog. You see him there on the right there. So one day, a particularly athletic frog, you see he's got his athletic shoes there, and he's got his running gear. He got out of the well somehow. He jumped out of the well and he started exploring. And before long, he came to the Pacific Ocean. Now, even we, who have seen the Pacific Ocean so many times, when we come to that ocean, pretty impressive. What to speak of this frog, who had only seen a little puddle at the bottom of his well. So he was flabbergasted. He'd never seen anything like it. So he reconnoitered a little bit, figured out what was going on, and then he jumped back into the well and came down, and he was breathless. He was telling everybody what he had seen. So naturally, Professor Frog, he wanted to find out what all this new information was. So he debriefed the frog. And the athletic frog was telling him, well, I saw this body of water that it was so big, the frog was considering. Oh. It must have been twice as big as the water in the well. And the other frog said, no, you do not understand. It was way bigger than that. So the frog, the Professor Frog, Dr. Frog, he said, oh, it was four times as big? And the other frog said, no, you don't understand. It's just beyond that. He said, oh, it must have been eight times. And each time that this Dr. Frog would give his consideration and his estimate, he would puff himself up a little more until finally, after he got to 10 times, he just burst, as frogs are prone to do sometimes when they get puffed up. So this is the parable of the frog in the well. And what it illustrates is our inability to understand things far beyond our present conception with our present senses. And so we will move on and we will consider our restrictions. So what this frog had engaged in is really what is known as the scientific method, which is the ascending process of knowledge, in which we gather information with our senses, we contemplate it with our mind, and we come to certain hypotheses concerning how the world works. And then we will test those hypotheses. And if they keep coming true and can confirm them, then we come to a certain theory. So the problem with this is that we're relying on our imperfect senses. And the senses, I think we can all agree, are limited. We have our eyes, our ears, our nose, our sense of touch, and around in the middle of them all is the mind. Now each of those senses has its limitations. For instance, the eye. Now, I have a little illustration here. The human eye can only see a small portion of the whole electromagnetic spectrum. Right in this room, for instance, there are so many rays. There's so many waves going on. There's a television going on. There's a radio. There is gamma rays. There's all kinds of rays beyond our little spectrum there of visible light. We don't see them. We don't even sense them. But they're undoubtedly here. So that's part of reality. But with our limited eyes, we cannot nearly perceive that. And so this is a severe limitation. If we are going to simply observe things and then come to conclusions, we'll have a very distorted view of reality. Now, it's true that in the modern day, in the last few hundred years, say, the eye has been magnified in the sense that the ability to see has been increased by microscopes, even electron microscopes, where we can see right into the atom and into the molecules. What to speak of the other side? The telescopes, the Hubble telescope. Every so often we get some more amazing pictures of what they consider to be out there in the galaxy that we can never see before because of the covering of the atmosphere here. So the eyes have been expanded, but ultimately what you get is you still get information that has to be processed through the limited brain, and you still are bound by those limitations of those that technology. So we can safely say, and I think all scientists would agree, that although we have expanded our knowledge, both macro and micro and macro, we still only know a small portion of what's out there, and so much more to discover. So this is the limitation of the eyes, and the other senses certainly have similar limitations. Who can deny that the ears are limited, or that the smell, sense of smell is limited, or that the sense of touch is certainly limited? So from these limited senses, that this is what we rely on, and in addition to the mind interpreting it, then what happens is we come to our next defect, and that is we make mistakes. These mistakes are innumerable. I think everyone has experience of that. And one mistake that I think stands out, this towering intellect. Remember Aristotle? When you study the how Western civilization came about, you often start with the ancient Greeks. They had so much knowledge. They invented democracy, supposedly. They had all these philosophers. So one of the main ones was Aristotle, who's often considered to be the first scientist. But from his limited perspective, without any modern technology, he concluded, and he wrote this down, that the purpose of the brain was for cooling the blood. That was the purpose of the brain. And that was taught in all the schools in Greece, and it came down. I didn't look up when that was finally discarded. But that was received and understood and accepted knowledge back in the ancient Greek days. So these mistakes are constantly being made. And if you read the history of science, just in my own little lifetime, so many things have had to be revised. Their understanding of the universe. Yes, we had the Big Bang. But now it's more complicated than that. There's all of this uncounted for matter in the universe that they can't figure out. They periodically have to rip up their latest theory about how the universe came to be or what's going on the micro level. That's why they spend billions on these cyclotrons. We used to call them cyclotrons. They just opened one in Europe, right? They were, super colliders. And the idea is to somehow find out how everything is working, right? And so wasn't there a scare that they were afraid? One guy was theorizing that the whole universe is going to explode when they start this thing up. So there was a little frisson of anxiety about that. I think they started it up, it didn't work, they postponed it. Anyway, that wasn't the end of the world. But they'll always have more and more frontiers of knowledge, more and more billions that they have to spend when they continue to use this method of relying on the limited senses or their expansions. So then what happens with all of these mistakes is that we're prone to illusion. Now, that's a serious problem because those illusions, they're kind of like codified mistakes. When everybody makes the same mistake for a while, then it's known as an established illusion. And the biggest illusion is that we're this body. That's a huge mistake, and it's a codified illusion that everyone is accepting. And on the basis of that, we lead our lives. We have aspirations, we develop relationships, We think what's important, what's not important, on the basis of the fact that our identity is tied up with this, where we were born, what language we speak, what family we're born into. All of those are based on the sense that I am this body, which is a grand illusion. Now, one that we can experience a lot and is common is this illusion of a mirage. A mirage, it may not be so clear here, but that reflection of that car in there is not really there. There's no water, and that reflection is simply an illusion. So that mirage is often compared to this material world, or rather our efforts at enjoying or becoming happy in this material world is a mirage. Akrura prays when he's praying to Krishna, in the 10th canto, he compares himself to an animal. You know, he's taking the role of a conditioned soul who is simply running after this mirage of material happiness and being cheated. When we think that these mirages are real, just like if you're in a desert and you see the mirage of a big oasis, you may run there if you're very thirsty or in trouble, but you'll find that ultimately it just evaporates. There's nothing there. So this whole idea that we are the body, that this material world is a place of happiness, that is a place for us to find some permanent security, is a big mirage. And although it seems to be true, if we just make this adjustment, that adjustment, if we elect this person, if we somehow make this investment, we never get to the point of actually finding that happiness and security here, because it's just a grand illusion. So our next problem is that when these illusions become established, then we cheat. When we believe our own illusions, or when we have a vested interest in others believing them, we cheat by teaching them as the truth. And this we saw with this Piltdown Man. Did anyone ever learn about Piltdown Man? I vaguely remember when I was in like first grade, which is about 1952, we learned about Piltdown Man. And Piltdown Man was discovered in 1912 in Britain, and he was thought to be a missing link between the ape and the man until the fraud was exposed in 1953. 40 years it was taught in textbooks, and the children grew up learning about this Piltdown Man. This was a fraud that was propagated by some British archaeologists who wanted to, you know, all of the ancient men with so-called, you know, discoveries were being found in Asia and Africa, so they wanted something to be found in Britain. So this Piltdown was somewhere in Sussex, somewhere. So they said, okay, we now have our own. And of course, a lot of fame, a lot of monies, grants and prestige comes from discovering such an important thing. So we're surrounded by such cheaters, you know. Just think about the economic disaster. It was a whole cheating thing that you can own your own house. Doesn't matter if you only make $8,000 a year. Yeah. No problem. You know, we'll give you this mortgage and you can own your own house. So fella moves into the house and they sell the mortgage off, you know. Banks don't care. And before long, he's buried under, poor family's buried under payments and he has to sell the house. So this is part of, there's a great motivation to cheat upon those who have control of the information channels. And so we're constantly being cheated. I mean, if you look back in history, there's just a series of the cheaters and the cheating. The cheaters and the cheating, probably called, that's what this world is all about. So the question is, what do we do now? If we want knowledge, but we have all of these limitations on this process of knowledge, which is what we call the ascending process, we need to find a method of knowledge where we won't be cheated, where we can have reliable information about the most important questions, not just how to make money or whatever, but more importantly, what is the origin of this universe? How did it come to be? Who are we really? What is our mission? Is there a mission in life? Is there a meaning to it all, or is it just meaningless? That's a logical question. If there is a source of everything, how can we know it in truth? All these, critical questions that people have asked since time immemorial. So Therefore, to find out genuine knowledge concerning ultimate questions of the origin of man in the universe, or the nature of the soul and the supreme soul, one must access a source of knowledge beyond these four imperfections. This is a basic principle of inquiry in Vedic understanding. There's something called a Paurusheya. Paurusheya simply means superhuman. It means beyond these four defects, because these defects are limiting us. We're kind of in the prison house. The other great analogy here, which we can contemplate, is this idea of Plato's cave. How many are familiar with Plato's cave? Yes, this is very good. Plato's, this is the same idea, is that he told this parable, or this story, of people who were raised in this cave, kind of a gruesome, you know, scenario, that they're completely in shackles, so all they can see is forward, so they're growing up there, they don't know anything else. And there's a fire behind them, and it's casting these shadows on the screen in front of them. And that's all they know of reality. You know, sometimes a little smaller shadow, but look, the shadow's a little smaller today. You know, that's a bright one, look at the outline, you know what I mean? Their whole worldview was marked by this shadow screen. And one fellow broke out, or was released, and climbed out of the cave, and he suddenly came into the bright sunlight. And it was dazzling. You know, it was too much, because he's so used to the cave, but gradually became accustomed to it, and there was a whole world out there. A reality of trees, of ocean, of rivers, of people, of experiences, that was far beyond the cave. And so after getting used to it and learning something, he went back in the cave, and he was trying to explain it, but no one could believe it. Because all they knew was what they saw from the shadow. And so they thought he was crazy. Or they thought he was making something up. Or he became, you know, like the town idiot or something. You know what I mean? In other words, the people didn't have, in the darkness, you know, this world is like a cave. And all we know is what we can gather through the senses. Or what's told to us by others who have gathered through the senses. You see the limitation? And so when someone has access to knowledge and reveals some knowledge beyond all of this, we tend to doubt it. We tend to think that it's crazy, it's mythology or whatever, because it doesn't compute. It doesn't fit into our worldview of how we think of ourselves and our world. So, but if we want to find out these absolute questions, we have to inquire from the right source. And therefore, we have this descending form of knowledge. Perfect knowledge descends from the perfect source, Krishna, through a chain of realized teachers and disciples, whose spoken and written words form reliable books of knowledge. So this is the key element. Now one may say, yeah, that's what you say, but I have some other source, so I doubt that there is such a source. But let's look at what we ordinarily do if we want to, say, go to college or go to the university. Suppose I want to study chemistry, or say organic chemistry. Now, I never studied organic chemistry, but when I my short college career, I met people who were studying it, and they said, "Oh, it's so tough. It's so hard, you know, because it's one thing you have to study to become a doctor, right? So it's kind of like, you know, a test of fire. If you can understand this organic chemistry, then you can proceed on your way to becoming a doctor. So it's very difficult. Now, what do I know of organic chemistry? Suppose I walk into a class. I actually walked into a class when I was in the University of Chicago for a few months back, many, many years ago. And it was one of these advanced math classes. My brother went to the show. And it was just, you know, all kinds of symbols on blackboards. They had these blackboards that would move, you know. There's four blackboards, they're moving back and forth until they can have like eight blackboards. And he was creating this proof, and I didn't. It might have well been in Chinese, or at that time, Sanskrit. I didn't know words. And I had, you know, no idea what was going on. But somebody did. There was a whole culture of knowledge. The students there were perfectly following it, and the teacher was like, he made an important proof or something. So suppose I want to enter into that. Well, I have to go, and I have to find an adequate teacher, someone who is renowned. Okay, University of Chicago, it's a good school. They have good teachers there. Yes, here's someone who has so many plaques on the wall, and who's got the Nobel Prize. Certified. He knows his stuff, whether it's math or organic chemistry. And there are certain books that are certified. Yes, this was written by so-and-so. And then I have to follow step by step. I have to take elementary chemistry. I have to, you know, gradually enter into the knowledge. And eventually, I'll know the organic chemistry and I can go on and become a doctor. So what's the difference? It's simply that when it comes to spiritual knowledge, when it comes to knowledge of the things that are way beyond our ken, you know, on that level, we tend to think that there are no experienced persons. There is no one who actually has seen the truth. So if we can have a little faith and we come in contact with persons who have seen the truth, who are experiencing it, who have experienced the benefits of the practice that has been given in order to achieve the truth, then we can enter into this understanding. So according to our Shastra, the original knowledge comes from the Supreme Source, Krishna, who enlightens Brahma in the heart. Brahma tried the investigative process. He tried to figure out where he came from. You know, he dove down the lotus stem, which is where the place of origin, but he couldn't find it. It was the wrong process. Only when he meditated, only when he performed austerity, only when he performed bhakti yoga, did he get a revelation that was he enlightened. This is how the knowledge comes. It comes down. So Brahma in turn enlightened Narada, his son and disciple, who in turn enlightened Vyasadeva, his disciple, who saw that the yuga was changing. He saw that Kali Yuga was imminent and that people couldn't hear as well. They couldn't remember as well. And so he, out of his great mercy, he wrote it all down and divided it into these, what we now call the four Vedas. He also wrote Mahabharata. Mahabharata is an exciting story. If you read Mahabharata, it's a real page turner. You know, there's so many, the main plot is very exciting, and the subplots are very exciting. And it's meant for us, especially, at this age. And right in the middle of that Mahabharata, what's there in the middle?
Bhagavad Gita.
To give us the essence of all the Upanishadic knowledge. So he wrote all of this, and finally his crowning achievement was the Bhagavad Purana, or the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the Simple Succession came down. Of course, this is just an outline. And eventually to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who took the role of a disciple in the Brahma-Madhva Sampradaya. And he in turn reconciled all kinds of the loose ends of philosophy. And he taught it to his disciples, especially the Goswamis, six Goswamis, who in turn wrote so many books. And the idea is that they're not just writing, learning and writing, but they're practicing. They're doing those practices by which Krishna within the heart enlightens, by which revelatory knowledge comes. And that's also explained in the Bhagavad Gita. If you look in the Bhagavad Gita for under knowledge, and you find where is knowledge described, especially in the 13th chapter, there's a whole section on knowledge from 8 to 12 in the 13th chapter, verses. And so much of it is behavior. What does humility have to knowledge? What does cleanliness have to do with knowledge? Can't I just open the book and read? You know? Do I have to also clean the desk before I open the book? What does that have to do? It means that there's a whole culture of knowledge. It's not just some information you're getting. It's a certain mode, what we call the mode of goodness, by which knowledge is not only coming from outside through the book and through the hearing of the learned sages, but it's also coming from inside, from Krishna, from the super soul within. So that's all of these great sages. Some of them are incarnations. They are in that receptive, or they're in that mode of the pure goodness by which knowledge expands. And then the modern representatives of this, what we call the Simplet Succession, are the Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Kodishodas Bhavati, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, Srila Prabhupada, and his successors. So this is how we get reliable knowledge beyond the realm of our senses. We're helpless here. We're just like the frog in the well. He may go on investigating, but he's never going to find out about the ocean if he just stays within that well. He has to either jump out of the well or rather have someone jump into the well who has seen the ocean, who can give him very accurate information. Now, this poor Professor Frog, he doubted. He was not equipped with the humility, with the proper frame of mind to receive the knowledge from his young guru. who would actually know more than him, because he investigated, he would have been able to have a revelation. So that is the attitude. So then finally we have this idea here that these teachers and these books are the basis of the universal society of Shikhanis. The reliable books of knowledge. Perfect knowledge descends from the perfect source, Krishna, through a chain of realized teachers and disciples who have spoken and written words for reliable books of knowledge. So this is the basis of our society, and it's the basis of our faith. Really, so much of Srila Prabhupada's mission was to come and teach what was in the books, what was in the Srimad Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavad Purana. And on the basis of that knowledge, he founded the movement. All of the practices that we follow, such as the chanting of the holy name, that is not something that he thought up. You know, this is a traditional practice, and it is part, integral part of the process of gaining knowledge, because it directly puts one in touch with the Supreme, so that purification can take place and revelation can take place. It is said of Gaura Kishoradas Babaji, who was the spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He was externally illiterate, couldn't even sign his name. And yet, because of his purity and his chanting and his devotion, whenever he spoke, the conclusions of the Vedas were manifest. Because Krishna is the origin of this knowledge, so if he is from within, it's coming from the heart. And one can speak in that way. And Srila Prabhupada also, in his writing of his books, in his speaking, you know, speaking, dictating his books or writing his books, he often felt, and he stated, that I'm not really writing these books. You know, this is Krishna writing the books through me. So this kind of knowledge is not accessible to those who simply rely on the senses or the mind or our limited intellect. And accepting that fact, it means we're in the proper receptive mood for hearing from the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita. And what happens is that if you kind of suspend your disbelief, Srila Prabhupada even talks about this in his introduction to the Gita, how at least theoretically we should accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead if we want to get the benefit of the Bhagavad Gita. But it's not all simply on the basis of that leap of faith, if you will. If one actually practices the processes told of in the Bhagavad Gita and exemplified by the teachers, one will begin to experience some of the benefits of Krishna consciousness. For certainly one will become more peaceful, more joyful. Just like the other day we were hearing, every so often you hear these nightmarish statistics of like the percentage of people in America or in the West generally who are taking antidepressants to fall asleep, to wake up, to just keep a better mood, in order to whatever, Well, we don't do that. I mean, our medicine is the holy name. It's even spoken of like that. Babaushadi, the chanting and hearing of the holy name and other vibrations about Krishna, is Aushadi means like an herbal remedy, for the disease of birth and death. And along the way, even just beginning the path, one experiences so many of the benefits. So that what that does is it confirms your faith that the rest of the path is true. Why would they mislead us? Is Rupa Goswami making up stories when he talks about diving into an ocean of ananda? Was he just speaking about kind of some good feeling he felt that day because it was sunny out or something? In other words, there's total credibility to the experiences recorded in the books of knowledge that we have. And if you take up the process, just like if you go into the university, you're going to undergo a change. You're going to be transformed. You go in ignorant, you come out knowledgeable. You'll be skillful in something. Right? So if you take part in the process, you chant the holy name, you try to imbibe the teachings in the Bhagavad Gita and employ them in your lives, then there will be a transformation of what's most important in life, which is your consciousness, your mood, your sense of self, your whole sense of purpose in the world. So this is the reality of Krishna consciousness. It's try and test it. The process of bhakti yoga as taught, especially in the Gaudiya Vaishnava community. And all over the world, people are benefiting. The Hare Krishna chant has finally caught on. It's being chanted by many, many more people than are in the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. Because it works, you know, even without any preconceived, without any practices. If you just do that one thing and chant with some concentration for a little time, you're going to experience a transformation. There will be a sense of happiness, a sense of joy. And the more that you chant, the more that you will experience. So this is, it's all based on this knowledge beyond, just to review, knowledge beyond the material senses and mind, coming down, and the practices are tried and tested. And we should, each one of us, try to take some more steps forward in our practice and our process, and learn more about this science. We have our book table outside, which is full of so many of the books that we have available. Some of you haven't begun benefiting from that knowledge, please take one book, even a small book, and enter into this whole different way of looking at the world and looking at oneself, which is really of a great benefit. So, thank you very much. This is our own presentation. If there's some discussion on these points, we can try to entertain that now. Yes, Dharma Seder. We can maybe turn the lights off.
Maybe historically, is there to depend upon the ascending process, because there's some of the things that have some change going on in the spiritual leaders or religions. I feel cheated, so better I just do it on myself because it's historically there. So.
Yes, this is very common, and this is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita in a purport in the fourth chapter, where Srila Prabhupada is going through and describing different ways in which people have resistance to entering into bhakti yoga. And one of them is exactly that because there's so much cheating going on, and one may actually experience that in one's own life, you know. I like to tell this story, forgive me, probably most of you heard it before, about my own faith. I was raised in a faith. It was the faith in communism. Straight on Marxism, Leninism. And I was completely convinced that this was the way to happiness in this world, and that religion was the opiate of the masses, and all of that stuff. And on the basis of that faith, you know, I joined so many movements, you know, SDS, I don't know if that means anything to you, you know, Students for a Democratic Society, which started in the University of Chicago. And I was leading my life on that basis. But then in the mid-60s, mid-late-60s, there started to be some anomalies. I think the invasion of Hungary was something. That was 56, and then anyway, there was something that happened in Czechoslovakia. In other words, they started to show their colors, that this was not a paradise, this was not a baby. So then I said, okay, forget about the Soviet Union, it's China, you know? And that's really where it's at. Mao Zedong. Forgive me. Hare Krishna. That's, I'm just showing how, you know, one faith to another, one faith. And then there was a book, I didn't read this book, but it was called The God That Failed, right? And this was by one of they became the neocons. The neocons, they were neoconservatives. They used to be leftists, you know, and then they saw what happened and, you know, all this stuff, and they lost their faith, the God that failed. And it really was like a God. You know, it was a form of worship and sacrifice. So after all of that, I didn't believe in anything for a while. I was just an existentialist. You know, whatever happens in the moment, that's it. Right? Let's just go on day by day. You know. By good fortune, you know, I eventually came in touch with the devotees, and just the process of yoga, hatha yoga, you know, which was, after all, you know, exotic in those days, in the early 70s. It wasn't that much yoga going on. But somehow or other, by Krishna's grace, I started doing hatha yoga too, just for the health reasons. and becoming in contact with it, because I had an inquiring mind, there were books about yoga, and there was also some books about the philosophy, and before long there was meditation, and there was mantra, and all of this stuff. And then, I came in touch with the Hare Krishna mantra, and it was all over. You know, once I started concentrating and chanting, there was something there, and I was drawn in, and I was fortunate. So, the idea is that this is a great barrier today, because there have been so many false gods, so many false philosophies, so many charlatans, that people naturally say, well, I'm not going with any one thing. I'm going to take a little from here, a little from there, and do my thing, and that's it. I don't believe in religion, but I'm a very spiritual person. Right? Isn't that what it is? I'm spiritual. I'm not, you know, religion. That's a bad name. Brand is kind of messed up. So, that's why Srila Prabhupada, when he came, actually he didn't call it, he said, it's a science. This is the science, you know, of bhakti yoga. Meaning that it is directly perceivable. We're studying this, but we missed a cell phone. I guess someone came in. Ninth chapter. We're beginning ninth chapter on evening classes. You're all invited, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, from 7:15 to 8:15. And then we have an ecstatic kirtan. What's not to like? So, anyway, we're studying the ninth chapter. The ninth chapter, Krishna, right away, he talks about his pratyakshavagamam. Pratyaksha means directly. Well, we just said how it's not direct. But the point is that if you follow the process, that quickly you come to some direct experience, which is scientific. In other words, it's not something you doubt. I'm feeling it. Just like with the Hatha Yoga. Yes, you do this bending and stretching, you do like this, and you feel much better. So it's confirmed. There's no question of doubting it. You know, if you eat a sweet ball, do you doubt that it's sweet? You don't doubt it anymore. Right? Beforehand, you may have so many doubts, but then when you directly experience, your doubts are wiped away. So the process of Krishna consciousness, yes, there requires at least some preliminary faith, some preliminary step of faith that you have to take, because it's so foreign. In other words, it's dealing with the soul and the spirit, which is something we may have not experienced before. We're so absorbed in the externals. But very quickly, if one simply suspends one's disbelief, even for a short time, and takes part in the process, the experience will be there. And gradually, in the association of others who are a little farther along, one can confirm the books of knowledge and the process of knowledge. So it is difficult, and there are millions of people who unfortunately have put up a huge blockage against anything, you know, as exotic as this, and they don't want to commit. They'd rather, you know, do a little here, a little there. But the fact is, if you want any process to work, you have to take it as it is. If you're going to do a diet, or if you're going to do some process of cure, you can't just, you know, play around with it, right? You have to actually follow according to the prescription of the experienced doctor or the experienced person who has gone before. Otherwise, you make a mess of it and you don't get the benefit. So, you know, this is our task. This is our duty as devotees to try to keep instilling faith and explaining again and again that this process works and it's real. And unfortunately,